Back together again on a midweek Wednesday, May 17th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We had our weekly check-in with Hearst Connecticut Media columnist and senior editor Dan Haar. He talked about a recent Yale study on the state's less than stellar investment strategy, and it ended up costing Connecticut billions of dollars. Family Institute of Connecticut Director of Public Policy Leslie Wolfgang briefed us on a controversial bill making its way through the General Assembly, and we also got a Capitol update, another one from Fairfield GOP State Senator Tony Wong. And I, of course, had a few thoughts today regarding the increasing propensity to demand that some people apologize for things that were said and done years ago. Midweek appearance, our buddy, our pal, Dan Haar, columnist and associate editor at the Connecticut Hearst Connecticut Media Group. Dan, good afternoon. Hope you're well. And baby bonds, they are born in Connecticut. Dan, what the heck is a baby bond?
A baby bond is a little bond that grows up. No, a baby bond is, and this is an innovative program developed in the previous administration with Sean Wooden, mm-hmm. The previous treasurer and the legislature. And under this concept, each child born in to a mother on Medicaid, Husky Medicaid,
sure.
gets a bond, in this case worth $3,200, and that bond is sits around for 18 years to 30, and that child who becomes an adult, if he or she still lives in Connecticut, can then have that bond with all of its new value proceeds, which is estimated to be worth, if it starts July 1st, 2023, which it will under this new agreement, to be worth somewhere between $11,000 and $24,000.
Wow.
And so, look, $11,000 to $24,000 is not going to it doesn't make a person rich, but it is a significant start towards easing not just the income gap. We talk a lot about the income gap.
Yeah.
But the more insidious inequity in terms of economics is the asset gap. And that is that people in poverty don't have assets. And you forget that even if you or I were to lose our jobs, we would still have some backup in net worth or assets,
yeah. mm-hmm.
presumably if we're, and so that's, you're trying to make that up. The problem was that Governor Ned Lamont did not support it theoretically. He didn't think that that's the best way to spend money. And B, he wanted to neither allocate the money year to year, $50 million a year, nor bond for it, because he thought those were financially unwise. And so what happened was they found the money under a couch cushion, $381 million. And that's what they're doing. I could actually explain where the money was.
Yeah, seriously, because the average person, Dan, will hear that and say, next question, where'd they find it?
Okay. All right. Bear with me here.
Okay.
Now, what happened was that in 2019, when we refinanced the teachers' pension fund, $22 billion or whatever it is, around there, Wall Street wasn't too happy with the condition of Connecticut in 2019.
Yeah.
And so very similar to when you get a mortgage and you need mortgage insurance, right? People have, if they don't have stellar credit, maybe, or if they do, they need, depending on the price of the house, they may need mortgage backup, mortgage insurance. This is essentially mortgage insurance for that teacher's pension fund, $381 million that was sitting in a fund just in case Connecticut defaulted. Wall Street wanted to see it. And then lo and behold, 4 years pass, and our financial, as we've all been talking about for the last 2 years, our fiscal condition greatly improved.
Mm-hmm.
We started showing big surpluses. And all of a sudden, the new treasurer, Eric Russell, who fully supported and strongly was battling, frankly, behind the scenes with the Lamont administration to get these baby bonds underway, discovered that this $381 million was no longer needed by the Wall Street lenders to show that Connecticut could pay that liability, that obligation. And so, poof, we have money.
Look at that.
And as you know, when you have money, good things happen.
Yeah. Before we get to the budget, I just realized something I do want to ask you, Dan. Regarding this report that came out a few days ago, that said that, listen, our management of some of our long-term funds here really wasn't great, to the tune of, like, we could have made another $27 billion. I mean, Dan, is that Monday morning quarterbacking, or how do you read that?
No. Well, first of all, if the governor can say it about President Joe Biden's reelection, I can say it about this report. Okay. It is a BFD.
Okay. No, that's all right. So tell us why.
This report is by Jeff Sonnenfeld at Yale is the real deal. And he had a team of people looking at all 50 states and comparing to the best of his ability, apples to apples, how did the various funds do?
Mm-hmm.
And Connecticut, the answer is that Connecticut did, significantly more poorly than 48 other states.
Wow.
Not necessarily significantly. Connecticut, for example, the three-year return through June 30th of 2022, Connecticut 5.4%, the national average 7.8%, I should say median. The best state was Washington at 12%. Only one state was worse at 4.9%, and the next worst state was California at 6%. So that's a lot of numbers. The bottom line is, over both 3 and 10, as well as other time frames, Connecticut did not do as well as other states, any way you slice it.
So who do we point fingers at, Dan? Is that, were we too cautious with our investing? Did these other states take chances? Were there legislative considerations of, well, we will invest in that, but we won't touch that? Why do you think it came out that way?
Well, it came out that way because of a historically poor system under which the Connecticut Treasury, as you may know, Connecticut has the strongest or second strongest fiduciary. That is, the treasurer in the state of Connecticut has the strongest rights of any treasurer.
Mm.
Almost every state is done by committee. There are two states that have the treasurer as basically a legal fiduciary, and those two states are Connecticut and North Carolina.
Wow.
And the bottom two states on all these lists are Connecticut and North Carolina.
Shocking.
And so part of it is that, and part of it is that we just simply have, even within asset classes, Connecticut underperformed. So in other words, part of the problem was we had the wrong asset mix, right? We guessed wrong on the asset mix. And part of the problem was, even within, let's say, private equity, right, we underperformed other states even in those asset classes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problems were top to bottom. I don't know if there's a person you can point to. I mean, there certainly are prior treasurers who held office, but, they had benchmarks that weren't working, and now you fix it. Treasurer Eric Russell has been hard at work trying to fix these things. He was briefed on the report in January at length. I don't mean briefly. And he already had reforms underway. The state, under the prior treasurer, Sean Wooden, the state already was reallocating its assets. They do it every couple of years or a few years. They do a study and say, what should the balance be? They were already doing that. So, it's a long process. It's very unfortunate, because the same amount of money that our hard-earned money that we've put into the treasurer's, into the pension funds, those $5.8 billion in the last 3 years, is pretty much what we would have had if we had done a decent job. So
sure. And Dan, finally, what are you hearing? What are your ultra secret sources, Dan, and otherwise at the Capitol, tell you about the situation with the budget?
Well, the column that I wrote today about that found money that saved the baby bonds.
Mm-hmm.
There's more found money to be had.
Excellent. And can I have some of it? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. You are going to get some, because it is. Almost impossible to imagine that there will be something other than the income tax cut that the governor and the Republicans want.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine that won't happen. Unclear is what other tax cuts we might get, but at the very least, there will be that. It is hard to imagine there will not be an increase in the earned income tax credit for low-income, working, poor families, especially with children. They get a significant benefits. That's going to increase. And it's hard to imagine that there won't be more money for UConn and the state university system than Governor Lamont proposed. Beyond that, the private nonprofit service providers may get a little bit more money, but they're not going to be happy. They never are, because it's not that they're complainers. It's that their mission is almost impossible to fulfill. And the various other social programs are going to suffer various fates, but there isn't a lot of money for them, not because we don't have the money, but because of the spending cap. And the spending cap restricts how much we can spend.
Excellent. Breaking it down for us, as he does every Wednesday afternoon, 5:05, Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media. Dan, thank you. Have a great week, and we'll talk next week. Thanks.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Dan Haar. There you go. How about that, folks, huh? The state fell short by $27 billion because our state treasurer, as Dan said, us in North Carolina, and ding, 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 we had the worst return, because I guess it's kind of, the state treasurer, what did Dan say, here in North Carolina, has extraordinary power. And I learned me something there, that the other states that did better kind of do it by committee, or the treasurer has more advisors, maybe, to speak up and say, hey, that's not a good idea, but that is. Man, oh, man. And to think that, you know, look, it's a Yale study. Like, did anybody from Hartford, hey, you guys at Yale, yeah, you're pretty smart, right? Yeah, Yale, go Bulldogs, yeah. Listen, we have some ideas. What do you think we should be doing? I don't know, man. It's just $27 billion. That we could have had we had another strategy. Now, I know you can Monday morning quarterback this, but come on. You know, it's frustrating, right? All these governors have always said, well, look at the colleges we have. We have Yale, we have UConn, we have Quinnipiac, we have Wesleyan. And yet, are we asking these people anything? Hello? There is a bill in the state that passed the House. As I understand it, it's on the way to the Senate, and it's got some interesting language in it. Now, some people are reading it and saying, oh, it's not a big deal, relax. And there are other people reading it saying, could this hamstring tenants, landlords, teacher, people who hire teachers, people who hire people who you have to keep an eye on around kids, around other people. Joining us to talk about this is Leslie Wolfgang. Leslie is the Director of Public Policy for the Family Institute of Connecticut. The FIC is raising the siren on this. And we'll get a little bit more into this right now. Leslie, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you? Hello.
Good, thanks, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well, and thanks for joining us on short notice, Leslie. I appreciate this, because I saw your tweet. There was an FIC tweet that's getting picked up by some conservative sites around the country, and it says that there's a change here being proposed in state law, Leslie, that some people need to read into. So what are you folks concerned about at the FIC, and what bill are we talking about here?
Sure. There's a lot of information at our website, ctfamily.org, and this is regarding House Bill 6638.
Okay.
And as you mentioned, it already passed the House, so it's on its way to the Senate. And this is a bill addressing Connecticut's anti-discrimination laws. Currently, the laws prevent discrimination against people who have a preference for heterosexuality, homosexuality, or bisexuality.
Okay.
This will untie, it eliminates those provisions, and instead protects people based on their identity, which is determined by their sexual, romantic, or emotional attractions. So it's basically adding the Q+ into anti-discrimination law.
All right. So the fear here is what, Leslie? Because I've read a couple of things, and talk about the fear here at least, which I know you people are talking about. Other people are saying, hey, come on, this is a stretch. But I know there is a fear here that if certain people have certain proclivities, this will end up being protected here. What's the deal with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's really not much to debate. It's right in the law, the bill as written. It protects sexual orientation, but it ties it to a person's identity as it relates to their sexual attraction. So it untethers it from it untethers it from the typical things that we think about. And it really just has to do with sexual attraction. And it brings in sexual attraction to children out there. And we already know that there's a movement to regularize and normalize attraction to children. This is, you don't have to be overly dramatic about it. There just are people who are sexually attracted to children. And we as parents and employers still have the right now to say, you know what, I'm sorry, you're just not a good fit for babysitting my children. Or I'm sorry, you're just not a good fit for working at our hospital or, you know, managing my restaurant because of your sexual attraction to children. Maybe your sexual attraction to babies, maybe your sexual attraction to people with disabilities or the elderly. You're just not a good fit, and I'm sorry. This law will prevent all those people from being able to, quote unquote, discriminate under those circumstances. Really, it's just an ability to use your common sense or to discern.
All right, Leslie Wolfgang is with us. A few more minutes with her. She is the Director of Public Policy for the Family Institute of Connecticut, talking about this bill that has passed the House, and now it's being at least considered by the Senate. If there's going to be a vote on this, we don't know. In fact, Leslie, do we know whether or not, with the compressed time frame here, with the budget and all that going on here, and tax cuts, is this bill definitely going to be voted on by the Senate or not? Do we know that?
No, we don't know for sure. The ways of the Senate and the legislature are mysterious. They make their own decisions, and we won't know until maybe that day whether or not the bill will be voted on. And so we really need to be on guard. We're only contacting senators at this point. We really need everybody to reach out to their senators, either in person when they come to your local pizza station or coffee shop, and talk to them about this bill. Write to them or contact them by email or phone.
Yeah, so, Leslie, as is pointed out in several spots, I think we can agree this is not in any way normalizing, you know, God forbid, pedophilia or all these sex crimes. These people are still going to go to jail. But I guess the fear here, Leslie, is what happens after... if this law is read a certain way, what happens after they complete, say, their state-assigned penalty? They've gone through jail and they've gone through whatever treatment they have to have. This, I guess, the fear is, Leslie, that it would tie the hands of landlords. It would tie the hands of, possibly, if it's interpreted that way, of hiring managers to say, hey, you cannot push this person away because of things you're worried about.
Well, you really have to separate the violation of the law based on somebody's action, which would still be illegal. Connecticut has a big Sex Crimes Act prohibiting all kinds of horrible activities, including sex with children. This is about the orientation. So this is about the attraction. Somebody, whether or not there are many people who have this attraction who never act on it, right? They struggle with it. Maybe they're on TikTok or they're on Instagram and they tell people that they have this. Yes, I find children sexy. This is sexually attractive to me. And they do have pedophilia, right? But they've never acted on it and they never committed a crime. This anti-discrimination bill would make it illegal. You and I will be dragged before the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities if we decide rationally not to hire that person who advertises on TikTok that they're sexually attracted to children for many good reasons, not to hire them, right? I would even say the vast majority probably of people who have this sexual attraction would say, I don't want to be anywhere near children.
Yeah.
But there are people who have this attraction and who do want to be near your children. And we as parents and employers should still have the right to be able to quote us, discriminate, really just make rational decisions. And I'm, because of your Instagram post where you say you are sexually attracted to children, I'm not going to hire you. And it's based on that. This will take away that from parents.
Interesting. Now, Leslie, have you gotten any blowback at FIC or heard from people who were saying, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. You're taking this to the nth degree. This is just about protecting people. Of course, the cops are going to clamp down on this. Are you hearing any of that from your detractors or not?
Amazingly, we have a lot of members who are I'm not going to say a lot, but we have people reaching out to us who are from the gay community, and they say, no, this is too much. Hmm. Parents do need to be able to make these rational decisions. Employers do need to be able to make these rational decisions. So we actually have gotten a lot of support, but I have to say we do, the people who object try and say, well, this just applies to people with genders. It's a sexual attraction to a gender. That's in the bill also. And I have to say that children, even by liberal standards, children and babies have gender, okay? Even, I'm sorry to say, and this is weird, but animals have gender.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Now, yeah,
you
know,
that part of the law, that behavior used to be tied to this section of the law that prohibited orientations based on criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. That is removed.
Yeah,
so
I did. Yeah, so
gender.
So they got the criminal aspect of this out. I noticed that's kind of the fulcrum of one of the fulcrums of the discussion here.
Right. So this is an actually just on its face. You know, all you have to do is just simply read the bill. It's tied to genders. And we know that adults have gender. This is by liberal standards, right? You see it all over the internet. The gender experts tell us that adults have genders, yes, but so do children, babies, animals have genders. So I'm not even being very outrageous when I say this applies to straight up pedophilia, people who have their own organizations saying that this is a sexual orientation for them and that they are sexually attracted to children.
Mm. The bill, once again, that Leslie told us about, so keep an eye on it. It is House Bill 6638 that has already passed the House, HB 6638. It's now for consideration in the Senate. We don't know if it's going to come up for a vote, depending upon all the stuff in the compressed schedule or not. But again, if you want to call your legislator in the Senate, be nice, be courteous, email, voicemail, don't scream and yell. Just tell them you're concerned about some of the aspects of HB 6638. Leslie Wolfgang from the Family Institute of Connecticut. Leslie, thank you. We'll chat down the road. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right. Leslie Wolfgang there again. This is HB 6638. You can read it at ctfamily.org, ctfamily.org. Now, again, the fear here, it's not legalizing pedophilia. It's not saying that you have to hire a convicted pedophile to work in your school or your daycare or your nursing home or whatever. But it does change the language, as Leslie said. You can read the bill. Check it out at ctfamily.org or go to any other governmental website in this state, you know, whether you want to try Ballotpedia or whatever, or the General Assembly's website. All you got to do is put in HB 6638, especially if you have kind of a legal background. Read this, and it kind of loosens up and, as Leslie said, removes the specter of criminal activity here. And just to say, well, if you believe in this sort of thing, there's no criminal activity, so you're a protected class. It's just, you know, I read this three or four times today, and it's one of these bills where you're like, nah, is this really necessary? Yeah, you see, this is one of those pieces of legislation where when you read it, you say, okay, but are we being flooded with people affected by this or not? Leslie, thank you. Let's head up I-91 or over there on I-84. Let's go to the Capitol and find out what's going on because the clock is ticking for stuff to get done here. Fairfield GOP State Senator Tony Wong, always our eyes and ears up there to tell you folks what's really going on. Tony, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
I am great. So exciting. The Capitol is buzzing with the general public and agencies and, of course, our lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only 3 weeks left until the end of the constitutional end of the General Assembly. You're chuckling with the lobbyists, right?
Well, I'm chuckling with the fact that you're the lobbyists and the 3 weeks. Tony, let me get your now that you bring that up, before we go to specific bills here. Do you guys and gals feel time constrained on this? Because I have always thought, Tony, that some of these limits, and people say, well, we shouldn't have a full-time legislature, but whatever. But I don't know, Tony, does it make for bad bill-making sometimes or not? That there's this gong waiting that you guys and gals have to meet no matter what?
Well, the Constitution requires us to end in 3 weeks. And then it just never stops, Paul. We're constantly working. Issues get raised. We're meeting with constituencies. We're meeting with interest to address issues. We are not a part-time legislature, even though people think that we're making millions of dollars and have the special interest plying our business. It's not Washington. We are a part-time legislator. Many of our colleagues have other roles. But nevertheless, it's an incredible honor to serve. So I'll say this. We can always use more time.
Yeah.
To craft bills, to really be able to hone and get expertise and manage it. But nevertheless, we're operating under a deadline,
mm-hmm.
and being able to press to get some bills done. Sometimes we do some really good work, and sometimes we need to come back and fix some of the things we might have missed. But right now, we're buzzing with activity. It's the first time in 3 years that people are back in the building.
Mm.
It's an energy level that we sorely miss, because democracy works best when we hear the people and not just the select few, as we've done for the last number of years. But the 800-pound gorilla, Paul, is we're still operating to try to get a two-year Connecticut state budget done.
Mm-hmm.
It begins July 2023 and runs to June 2025, we're biannual budget. It's interesting because there are actually four budgets being presented for the first time in this year. We've got the governor's budget that came out in February. We've got the Democratic legislative body and appropriations and finance that came out with their budget. And we also had the House Republican, and then about last week, 10 days ago, the Senate Republican, which I was a part of, came out with a budget. The House Republican, the Senate Republican, mirrored a lot of the fiscal guardrail mm-hmm. policies of Governor Lamont.
Yeah.
We also look to make priorities in addressing different issues. The difference between the House Republican and the Senate Republican is the Senate Republican really focused in on tax cuts.
Okay.
We proposed a $1.52 billion tax cut to be able to give money back to the working and middle class, because Connecticut has benefited from inflationary taxation revenue as well as the struggles that we've had. But we have had some federal surpluses in regards to ARPA,
mm-hmm.
that it's time with the vaulted surplus that we keep talking about to be able to give some relief, property and as well as tax relief to the working middle class. So I can say proudly for the Senate Republican that we have offered the highest tax cut budget out of the four. But it is a work in progress, and it is the 800-pound gorilla that will govern everything else we do. Until there's a budget,
sure.
we're kind of negotiating back and forth. But I'm hopeful that we will get some budget to move forward. Then it'll really break open the logjam of legislating coming through. You'll see it.
Yeah.
Once the budget gets approved, we're going to see a plethora of bills coming through.
And, Tony, part of that budget is, well, I have people that call me, and we do hours of phone calls on it. The governor is sticking to his guns about how much is the state income tax going to be cut. The governor seems to be, Tony, you tell me, I don't know, I haven't read the specifics, he seems to be a little closer to you guys on the Republican side. There are still some squishy folks on the Democratic side. Any indication where that discussion is now, Tony, regarding a cut in the Connecticut state income tax?
Well, there's going to be a cut. All four of the budget proposed different levels of cuts. Even the Democratic legislature proposed a quarter point cut in income tax revenue collections. But nevertheless, we are also governed by a fiscal guardrail in regards to our spending and in our bonding caps that has resulted in the surplus and the fiscal health of our state. I applaud that from the General Assembly and also to Governor Lamont that we've been able to get there. Let's not abandon those kind of practices and govern within our means. But at the same time, set priorities. And I can share with you, for the Senate Republicans,
mm-hmm.
our priorities can be encapsulated. Middle tax, working class tax relief, supporting our education, supporting our nonprofits. In fact, the Senate Republican proposed the highest allocation of 2% increase to our nonprofits. Obviously, our nonprofits are looking for mm-hmm. a significantly higher number, but yeah. I can proudly say our 2% is the highest percentage of increase to our nonprofits out of the four budgets. But nevertheless, it is really about managing within our means and our budgetary process, but also giving relief to Connecticut residents. Because Connecticut, if you talk up and down Main Street, they're worried about economic challenges that are coming through with what's going on in Washington and internationally. We need to give people relief because Connecticut is unaffordable.
Hey, Tony, Tony Wong with us for a couple more minutes here. Tony, I took a good amount of calls the other day on an interesting topic. I guess there's a bill floating around up there, and you tell me what the status is. I'm not sure because I haven't seen a final vote that would mandate some ideas, Tony, I guess by this coming February of next year, on perhaps getting rid of or significantly changing the motor vehicle taxation here in this state. And I guess the elephant in the room here, Tony, is how do you replace that revenue? Because you and I both know municipalities, Tony, they require that money. They rely on it. So if you're like me, and Tony, I despise that tax. I can't stand it. But what are some of the ideas up there, Tony, that may come out of this commission that's supposed to have a legislative approval there, if so?
It is a working group that has been proposed in planning and development. It became a study, and it became a study about how we can replace our motor vehicle taxes with other forms of revenue. Here's the point. The motor vehicle tax, believe it or not, Paul, was supposed to be temporary.
I read that
30 years ago. And here's the problem with taxation.
Never goes away.
We as a legislative body, once a tax is in place, once a program is in place, it is nearly impossible because it's well-intentioned. But it never, ever goes away. And the other reason why it doesn't go away is our municipalities have struck a deal with state government to say, you impose the motor vehicle tax, the revenue comes back to our municipalities. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, every single governor that I've been involved, from O'Neill to Rell to Rowland to Malloy, have all proposed getting rid of the insidious tax.
Yeah.
The reason why is it's governed by mill rates. And the problem is a car, a Honda 10-year Accord, could cost significantly different in Greenwich versus in Hartford.
Sure.
So it is an uneven assessment tax, but it's a tax. So we'd love to get rid of it, but the problem is, where do you supplement it? This is a study. We're not moving forward. We're making any changes. I believe it was about 3-4 years ago, we looked to put a cap, and the legislator says, for those that are losing money because of the cap, we're going to reimburse you.
Yeah.
We didn't fully reimburse people, so communities lost money. So I don't think they're going to take that bait again. If we're going to do anything on motor vehicle tax relief, my proposal and debate on the Senate floor was this. We need to understand how we spend the tax money we collect, and we need to manage within our means. And before we assess any new taxes, we need to reevaluate its implication down the road. And that's why this year, the opportunity to make tax cuts and a $1.52 billion tax cut from the Senate Republicans is the largest tax cut in the history of this state. That's truly saying something.
Yes, well, now, Tony, we have to go now, but I know you said you've only got 2 or 3 weeks left, so I think there's plenty of time because we know how the end of the session is, Tony, so make sure you get you pack in your rations there in your office, your survival food, get the air mattress ready. I want to make you comfortable for those last 24 or 48 hours that we know is coming up, Tony. You're going to be all right in a couple of weeks, right?
But you know what, Paul? It is the greatest honor we have to be able to serve. And yes, it's going to be a real boondoggle from a standpoint of work and what you talked about. But you know what? We're able to do some really good things, too. And you know, we've done something on youth internet safety.
Mm-hmm.
We've done a bill on domestic violence protection and prevention, that individuals that are repeat offenders of domestic violence protective orders now need to wear a monitor system. We hope that it gets out of the House. So, Paul, we do some good things.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely.
And we do some silly things, too. I think we're going to talk about having pizza be the state
oh,
food.
Oh, my God. Here comes the battle, Tony. The pizza camp versus what? The New England lobster roll camp, right?
I don't know. I'm in favor of the pizza. pizza. I'm in favor of the pizza. You do a great job, and it's always an honor and a pleasure to be on with you.
All right, Tony, thank you. Appreciate that. State Senator Tony Wong there from Fairfield. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, but that's – folks, there's time left in the General Assembly to get that battle. Is it pizza, the official state of Connecticut food, or will it be – now, be careful. When you say lobster roll, it's New England lobster roll, not the Maine lobster roll, which is basically a hard roll with mayonnaise and lobster there. No, we go for the hot butter in Connecticut there. You know, one thing that I absolutely can't stand that drives me crazy is this need we have now and didn't necessarily start right now in the year 2023, but it's been going for 5 or 6 years. This need for everyone and everybody in any city, in any town, and every organization to apologize for something that you or they or we or I may have said or done years ago that by today's standards, that by today's lane of thinking is not acceptable. So even though this country or certain people or certain groups or certain organizations did stuff 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that may have been, even in a bad situation, a norm of society, we suddenly have to pull back and say, oh, I'm so sorry I did that. Please, please don't hold it against me. When what you may have done or said or took part in years ago was perfectly normal. There might not have been one skosh, one iota of impropriety there. And we're not talking about slavery in this case. We're not, and by the way, the whole thing where now, you know, this generation, me, people like me, have to apologize for slavery. Why? Just a side note here. Why? I think slavery is abhorrent. I would have never owned a human being. But that's kind of sort of beside the point. What am I talking about here? And I don't know whether you've been following this or not, but my God, I read this story and I'm like, geez, this happened years ago. And we're going back and we are again, for some reason, choosing to redefine history or remake or, you know, rewrite history here. Just a brief summary of this, but this stuff, it drives me nuts. The having to explain yourself as to what you did and why you did this and now trying to issue some sheepish, half-hearted, apology for something that at the time you did this wasn't probably the least amount of anything that generated any sort of controversy. This is from the Hartford Courant. Governor Ned Lamont's nomination of a state Supreme Court justice stood in jeopardy yesterday. You may be following this amid a firestorm of controversy over abortion, which is Connecticut's favorite sacrament now. Democrats in Hartford, why don't we change it to the abortion state? We're not the nutmeg state anymore, the Constitution state. Why don't we change it to the abortion state? And her experience. Now, experience in legal point of view, I'm not talking about here, because I will tell you right up front, I don't know what kind of legal experience would constitute a proper amount of experience for a state Supreme Court justice. I'm frankly just not smart enough to know that. That stuff is way above my pay grade. Traditionally, a judicial nominee by a Democratic governor is virtually guaranteed to be confirmed here in the state when fellow Democrats control both chambers in the legislature. But lawmakers are still raising questions about federal prosecutor Sandra Slack Glover. Now, this is Governor Ned Lamont's nomination or nominee to be a justice on the state Supreme Court, which is, you know, which is no small accomplishment. I mean, if you can't sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, I would imagine if you are a justice on your state Supreme Court or a high-ranking justice on the federal bench, well, that's probably something. You get a couple of plaques on your wall, I would think. So it turns out that the main sticking point here, and once again, there's the main sticking point this, and, you know, there's her experience here, but the main reason for this controversy is that 6 years ago, back in 2017, Glover signed a letter supporting Amy Coney Barrett to become a federal appeals court judge, not putting her on the Supreme Court. You understand here? This has nothing to do at the time with Amy Coney Barrett and her eventually getting to the U.S. Supreme Court via a nomination by former President Trump at the time, and then a successful nomination here. Long before Barrett became a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And yes, she took part in overturning that Roe v. Wade decision. Now, here's the part. The nominee in question here, Sandra Slack Glover, who I guess the governor is standing behind, good for him, she apologized this week for signing a letter supporting Amy Coney Barrett to become a federal appeals court judge and told the Judiciary Committee that she is a strong supporter of abortion rights. And you obviously have, Ms. Glover, don't have a spine, I guess. She apologized this week for signing the letter. That letter had nothing to do with Amy Coney Barrett showing up on the U.S. Supreme Court. It literally didn't. Now, was she on a short list? Maybe. But again, when you currently reside in the state of Connecticut, which again is not the Constitution state anymore or the Nutmeg state, it's now abortion. It's the abortion capital of America, pretty much, with everything we're doing here. This woman, who apparently had some sort of high legal standing here to sign that letter supporting Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to a federal bench, she had to apologize for this week. Why are you apologizing for that? Did you not feel at the time that Amy Coney Barrett was qualified to sit on the federal bench? And then she watches, and then she says this, quote, "In 2017, I was scared like everyone else. I went to Washington the day of the inauguration for the Women's March because I was scared. But I also believed clearly, naively at this point, that there were guardrails, and I thought they would hold. And I thought that lower court judges were constrained. I thought the Supreme Court was constrained, but I was wrong. Looking back, I now know I shouldn't have signed it." Oh, stop. Come on. Were you up at a hearing the other day in front of legislative leaders, or was that at the Goodspeed Opera House? Or the Schubert in New Haven? Man, this whole thing. And then Matt Ritter, the House Speaker, says, you know, that letter has really impacted a lot of people's thoughts on that. I know she regrets it, and I'm sure she wishes that she never signed it, but there are some people who can't get over that. Politics is a lot of luck and timing, whether you're running for high office or getting appointed. Oh, okay. So we're going to play that game. We are so phony. I'm telling you, this whole, why did you sign that, Ms. Glover, at that time? Well, maybe she thought Amy Coney Barrett was pretty smart on all things judicial, and she thought she'd make a good federal judge. What's the big deal? Well, you know, she went on to the Supreme Court. Would this woman have been able to know that at that time? No. But, of course, we're going to sit back here and say, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry for what I did. You know what I would have said if I was up there? I would have said, Senator or Representative was ever questioning me, yes, I signed that. And in retrospect, certain things have happened in this country, but I don't regret signing that at all. I don't. Folks, I'm serious. Because if I'm and I know this woman probably wants to be on the state Supreme Court. I get that. I get that. Like, there are jobs in this business years ago I wish I had. And there are probably a couple of jobs that I could have gotten, but I was told by the people interviewing me, well, you kind of have to do A, B, and C, and I didn't like a couple of things that I heard back then. I didn't get the job. I don't care. I stood up for what I thought was right. And I just, this whole thing about apologizing, and again, I don't necessarily pin it all on this controversy regarding Sandra Slack Glover, but this society that we're in right now drives me crazy. I'm sure at the time, Ms. Glover thought that Amy Coney Barrett had a fine legal mind, like everybody at the time said she did, and that's why she signed the letter. She supported Amy Coney Barrett to become a federal appeals court judge. All right. What's the big deal? This was, as the Hartford Courant points out, long before Barrett became known as one of the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. So now, our members of the House and Senate have her up there and making her essentially grovel, that she's got to go up there and saying, well, she had to apologize for signing it. I mean, think about that. I would have said, no, I don't apologize for it. At the time, I was asked about a specific situation. Would Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the federal appeals court, the appellate bench, be okay? And I would have said if I was her, yeah, I thought it was. Since then, she's made a ruling maybe that I don't agree with. But my God, this notion that we have lawmakers who, you know, ask her about an opinion she had of a person. And you mean to tell me that all these committee chair people and co-chair people and ranking members, so they didn't do things years ago that if we asked them about right now would say, would make people say, well, you maybe shouldn't have this position in the General Assembly? This is ridiculous. This is just part of a society we're in. That for some reason, whether it's an opinion you signed, whether it's something you said, whether it's slavery, whether it's a college course you took, whether it's something you said on radio or TV 30, 40 years ago, we've entered this nauseous phase in our history where we do, well, how do you feel about that now? I'd say, well, frankly, Mr. Chairman, it's none of your damn business how I feel about that now. How about that?